Welcome to another episode of Across the Pond, where we discuss the key developments and investment themes shaping markets across Europe and Switzerland. Today, we're turning our focus to the UK, where the political landscape has shifted rapidly in recent months. Less than 2 years after winning a substantial majority, Keir Starmer has stepped down as Prime Minister, and the country is preparing for another leadership transition. For many international listeners, these changes raise important questions about the direction of UK policy and the broader outlook for the region. Are these shifts primarily about leadership, or do they reflect deeper structural changes in the UK politics? How much of the current environment is still influenced by the legacy of Brexit? And with Andy Burnham now the clear frontrunner, what do we actually know about his policy agenda and the potential implications for the UK economy and markets? I'm Belinda Ulander, and in this episode, we'll address the main questions. Why has political turnover accelerated? How has the party system evolved? And what should investors be watching as new policies emerge, from central bank decisions to bond markets, sterling, and equities? I'm joined today by Dean Turner, UK economist at UBS, and of course, my co-host, Christopher Swan. Together, we'll examine the underlying trends in British politics and consider what they could mean for investors. Dean, welcome to the podcast. Chris, let's kick it off with the first question.
So from an international perspective, I think a lot of listeners might be a little confused about what's happened in UK politics. Keir Starmer was elected less than 2 years ago with a very large majority, and we weren't due for another election for another couple of years after this. So what exactly has gone wrong with Keir Starmer? What has happened here?
Yeah, so I think it's been a number of factors. The first thing we cannot ignore is that notwithstanding the size of the majority that Keir Starmer won, his share of the popular vote was actually one of the lowest on record. So, you know, as his premiership has endured, his popularity, which wasn't a particularly high starting point, has fallen quite considerably. And that's made a number of Labour MPs quite nervous, especially as the next election is only a couple of years away. But behind that as well, and you know, what explains some of that fall in popularity of the Prime Minister has been a sense that a government that hasn't been delivering on its manifesto promises, there's been pretty poor execution, there's been a number of U-turns on key policy initiatives. It's just left the whole sense of a government that isn't delivering. And overall, that's left us in a situation where the opinion polls strongly favour a change of leader. And for that reason, Sir Keir has had to step aside.
And if I'm not mistaken, the country now has had its seventh prime minister in a decade. Mm-hmm. And we also remember the Liz Truss episode, who I believe only lasted 44 days. So obviously Starmer did better than that. But what's driving this constant leadership turn? Is the UK just becoming harder to govern?
I'm always reluctant to say the UK is becoming harder to govern. I don't think governing the UK has ever been easy. But certainly one of the things that that we are seeing is that UK voters are just, you know, they're not feeling the kind of change that they would have expected to see over the last 10 years. And a lot of that does come down to the fact in terms of what we've seen in terms of pretty lackluster economic growth. And why that matters is because living standards for most households are not falling, but, you know, I suppose they can be described as stagnating. And in a world where, you know, people expect that things in the future will be better, every generation in recent memory has expected that they'll do better than their parents' generation, that's becoming a bit of a problem. And, you know, politicians are just failing. Politicians of all stripes, let's be clear about this, have failed to deliver on much needed change that can get the economy going again. And until that changes, I think the outlook for political volatility in the UK is probably going to remain quite high.
Yeah, and I guess it sort of goes back to sort of 10 years ago when the British voters decided to deprive me of my European passport and you too, Dean. are we still suffering a little bit of a hangover from that period? I mean, it does seem that the party system has rather fragmented. There's sort of maybe sort of still divisions within the Conservative Party. How would you evaluate the lasting effects of the Brexit vote over the past decade?
Yeah, so for me, I look at the legacy on voting behaviour and voting patterns as a result of Brexit, and you've kind of touched on this, and you know, it really did establish a fragmentation from the old two-party system that that used to dominate British politics. Another thing that's happened as well is a lot of the old kind of class-based voting structure that was very common in the UK for a number of years has essentially changed. So what you're seeing is that, you know, the traditional voting constituencies for the Conservative Party and the Labour Party have changed dramatically. So a lot of, you know, ex-Labour voters will now vote Reform or even Green. A lot of Conservative voters are also switching to parties like Reform. But equally, you know, both parties are picking up voters in areas that they hadn't done previously. And, you know, it's really this underlying change in terms of how the population is voting. I also get a sense that the population seems to be a little bit more fluid. Historically, you know, people would vote for parties on the basis of tradition. You know, it's what we've always done. But ultimately, you know, we are now seeing that voters are willing to, you know, be a bit more flexible with their vote, and they will start to vote on issues that matter more to them.
And what do we actually know about Burnham's policies, policy proposals so far? He's made some headlines by saying he won't raise taxes or wants more public ownership. So what are the main things that people be watching out for as his agenda takes shape, perhaps also key appointments and the overall direction he might set?
So in terms of what we currently know about Andy Burnham's policy proposals, you've correctly said it's not much. He's made a couple of speeches of late. What we can gather is that this, assuming he does become the Prime Minister in mid-July, this is a Prime Minister who will favour a greater intervention of the state. He's a Prime Minister who's strongly in favour of devolution. And for our US listeners, you know, just to be clear what that is that the UK has historically been dominated or, you know, governed from London, from the centre. And he's very keen to promote, devolution agenda that sees decision-making powers devolved to other parts of the country. So that's going to be another key thing of what his policies are proposing. He's very in favour of things like building more homes. You know, one of the things that makes voters particularly grumpy in the UK is the cost of housing. And the reason we have such high cost of housing is because we don't build enough. So that's something he wants to tackle. But ultimately, all of these things are going to cost money. Now, Burnham has suggested that he's going to stick to the existing Labour Party manifesto pledges, that he won't increase the main taxes, which in the UK are income tax, national insurance, corporation tax and VAT. But he has also indicated that he sees that there is room elsewhere within the tax structure in the UK to raise taxes. So, look, I think we're in a situation where we've had pretty sharp tax rises in the UK over the last couple of years. It seems the direction of travel is that that's going to continue. But ultimately, we're not going to know anything with any clarity until it's Burnham or another candidate has been formally appointed as the next Prime Minister.
I mean, I guess we jumped the gun ever so slightly in assuming completely that Andy Burnham will be the next Prime Minister. I remember that the Labour Party election process is very, very complicated for a leader. But I'm also getting the sense that because there are no rivals, is this likely to be more of a coronation as opposed to a sort of an election campaign for leadership, I mean?
I think that's that seems to be the case throughout the last couple of weeks since Keir Starmer announced he's stepping aside. There's been constant speculation about who will challenge Burnham for the leadership, but ultimately it seems that most Labour MPs, and to be clear, it's only existing Labour MPs that can challenge Burnham for the leadership. Most Labour MPs seem to accept that, you know, if it were to go to a competition, and that competition is essentially it goes to a vote of all members of the Labour Party, Burnham would be pretty hard to beat. So, you know, it just drag out a process. And, you know, there is some benefits of having a swift handover. And it's not the first time it's happened. You know, when Tony Blair stepped aside for Gordon Brown back in 2010, we had a situation where we had a very swift leadership transition. And that does have a benefit in terms of, you know, it removes uncertainty. People know the Prime Minister is going to change. There is some benefit in just, you know, getting it done and finding out the new policy agenda ASAP rather than months of a fractious battle between potential rivals.
And I would also like to talk a bit about the Bank of England and central bank policy. With all this political change, could we see any implications for the bank's approach to interest rate or monetary policy?
No, is the short answer.
Come on.
Always
don't. Very boring answer.
No, but look, we have to focus on what matters for the Bank of England, and that's inflation. And look, you know, a change in leadership will be a consideration. One of the things that we've observed over the last couple of years is that the Bank of England has been slower to lower interest rates than other central banks in Europe. And part of the reason for that has been that the fiscal position in the UK, higher taxes and higher spending, has arguably been one of the factors that has kept inflation a little bit higher than it otherwise would have been. So that does result in policy being a little bit tighter than perhaps the counterfactual. So, you know, if we were to get a government that comes in and has very high ambitions to increase spending and, you know, add to inflationary pressures in the economy, it could potentially change the outlook there. But my sense is that, you know, the changes that we're going to see, at least over the foreseeable future, you know, the next 12 months or so, are going to be relatively minor. Inflation in the UK is still running above target. It's going to be that way for some time. So I would expect that, you know, we're not going to hear much from the Bank of England, at least in terms of policy, at least for the remainder of this year. As we move into next year, if inflation pressures start to fade, we could see that some interest rates start to be delivered. But, you know, as things stand right now, the jury is out on that.
So maybe a follow-on question on the bond market. Obviously, the UK had a sort of warning shot about unfunded borrowing under a former Prime Minister, Liz Truss, which sent yields considerably higher. I'm guessing that's a sort of lesson that everyone has now. That was a Conservative Prime Minister, but I'm guessing that's a lesson that has been fairly convincingly learned. I seem to remember Andy Burnham said something that was perceived to be provocative about the bond markets, like we shouldn't be paying quite so much attention to them. But that since then he's got some pretty, shall we say, fiscally conservative advisers, and the expectation presumably is that he won't rock the boat.
Yes, I think that's right, Chris. You know, the point on advisors, I think, is quite key here. One of the team advising Burnham on economic policy is Richard Hughes, who is the former head of the Office for Budget Responsibility, which is the organisation in the UK that crunches the numbers that determines whether we meet our fiscal rules or not. So it seems very unlikely to me that Burnham would pursue a fiscal stance that would result in more, you know, let's just say a deterioration in the state of public finances. You know, one of the things that it should be acknowledged actually is that, you know, notwithstanding all of the noise and the concern we have around finances in the UK, and international investors have about the UK, the public finances are actually in reasonably good shape. And, you know, I suspect that as and when the next budget does come, sometime in October or November, yes, we'll get a a bit of tax increases, but you know, it's more going to be, you know, moving, you know, juggling the numbers within the existing within the existing framework, rather than a situation where we have a massive unfunded increase in spending.
And how could this play out in currencies, especially sterling? Markets haven't reacted much at all, but as Burnham's policies start to take shape, do you think this could drive any moves in the pound?
Yes, I think it could. I think what unsettles markets or investors don't like is just uncertainty. I think once we've got the clarity that the change of leadership in the UK has come through, we've got clarity on who's going to be the Chancellor, we've got clarity in terms of where fiscal policy is heading, then investors can get comfortable with that and start to think about what it means for what it means for the currency when you're looking at the fundamentals of the underlying economy. Now, when we actually look at those fundamentals of the underlying economy, I look at the UK today, I see an economy that's growing. Yes, inflation's a little bit higher, but it's coming down. But a consequence of that higher inflation is that we do have higher interest rates from the Bank of England. You know, base rate is stuck at 3.75. Bond yields are a little bit higher. So from an international investor perspective, you know, that kind of yield attraction in the UK actually looks quite good right now. And arguably, that we think that's going to be one of the factors that encourages international investors to continue to look at the UK, and that's going to be something that supports sterling. So if I take a 12-month view here, cable, which is the pound dollar exchange rate, currently trading at around 132, 133, we expect that can rise to as high as 140 within 12 months.
And the UK equity market, you've pointed this out to me on many occasions, is quite sort of, for want of a better word, cosmopolitan. That is to say, it's a bit divorced from the UK economy itself. If I remember correctly, something like 75 to 80% of revenues for the FTSE 100 come from overseas. But are there any potential feed-throughs into the UK equity market? I mean, particularly if you see more pro-growth policies over the longer term, or is this really an irrelevance?
I wouldn't say it's a complete irrelevance. You know, you're absolutely right that most of the revenues for the large UK companies do come from overseas, but there are elements of domestic exposure that will matter there. You know, we have a number of domestically focused banks, for example, that could arguably see a sentiment towards them improve if we get a better outlook on the economy. And there's also other domestically focused sectors as well. But in my mind, that's going to be quite a minor part of the overall story here. What the factors that will drive UK equities going forward is that pretty resilient backdrop for the global economy. We still have positive growth. We've had a bit of a positive news now in terms of what's happened to energy prices. And it's that international or global growth outlook that's probably going to be supporting the UK equities. The other factor that that will support the UK market as well is its cheap valuation. You know, and the cheap valuation matters because one of the phenomena we are seeing is a lot of M&A activity is happening. You know, companies coming in and buying what are perceived to be cheap UK stocks.
Unfortunately, we don't have any more time for questions, but thank you so much, Dean, for joining us again today. And also thank you for our listeners. As always, we can discuss individual securities on this podcast, but you can explore these topics further with your UBS representative. But just to sum up, with another UK leadership transition underway, we don't expect any immediate changes to the Bank of England's policy. Rates are likely to remain on hold as inflation stays above target. Fiscal policy should remain prudent, so we see UK government bond yields as stable and any moves gradual. Higher yields and a resilient outlook continue to support sterling, with some scope for further appreciation as uncertainty clears. While domestic policy changes may have some impact, the bigger story for UK equities continues to be global growth and sector trends. We see selective opportunities, especially in internationally exposed sectors and areas where valuations remain attractive. We'll be back soon with another episode of Across the Pond. Thanks so much for listening and have a great week.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.